Have you ever heard of hip dysplasia? Up until recently, I wasn't overly familiar with hip dysplasia, and it can be quite hard to diagnose with a simple hip examination. Some babies will go missed even with this examination at early age. So if there's any doubt or concern with the risk factors that might play a part or with clicky hips of your baby, it's worth getting an opinion. Luckily nowadays, we have the advent of ultrasound and x-ray, which helps us pick up hip dysplasia earlier and with more confidence. But it's still not easy. And I think that's what Sarah, my next guest, realised, is that hip dysplasia doesn't have a massive awareness in Australia. She set up the foundation Healthy Hips Australia, which offers support to parents who are both curious about this condition, but also who are going through this condition and where they can get help and the latest evidence on treatment and guidelines. So I'm really interested to hear from Sarah, who's also had a baby going through this, and I guess that's what's inspired her to reach out to others and help them along the way.
Raising children can be one of the most challenging life journeys you will ever take. This is the Kids Health Network podcast, supporting happy, healthy children and demystifying common medical and psychological problems with experienced health professionals. Hosted by father of two and general practitioner, Dr. Andrew Leach.
Get in touch with us with ideas. Email kidshealthnetwork@outlook.com. The Kids Health Network is a support service for kids and their families. Please rate us on iTunes. Thanks for tuning in.
So I'm very fortunate to be joined by Sarah, who is the founder of Healthy Hips Australia. Thanks for coming today, Sarah.
No problems, Andrew.
Sarah, I guess the best place to start with this is what led you to creating a foundation such as Healthy Hips Australia, and where your interest is driven from.
Yep. So 7 years ago, my firstborn daughter was born. She was a breech baby, and we were told at the time that she might have some hip issues. So I went home and did a little research to find out what hip issues meant, and it turned out that that was hip dysplasia, which is commonly found in children who are breech. So she ended up having 2 years of treatment for hip dysplasia, and then her sister, who was born 2 years after her, was diagnosed as well. And when I got probably halfway through her younger sister Maya's treatment, I was starting to look at what reliable sources of information, resources and support there was out there for parents. My background's an occupational therapist, so I found my way through the process relatively okay, but I still felt quite overwhelmed and uninformed. And when I realised that there was no organisation in Australia for hip dysplasia support or awareness, that's where the idea was sparked.
Mm. And that's really taking it to the next level, being driven by your own experience and then actually creating something to help awareness about that experience. And I think that's, you know, that's quite incredible to really do that, you know, and help to inform other parents who are going through that journey that you've got.
Yeah, I think I felt at the time like, why me, when my second was diagnosed. And then I had this moment where I went, well, maybe there's a silver lining to this. And when I looked at my background in health, I felt that I was able to relate to health professionals working with the children with hip dysplasia, and I could understand the processes that they were going through in terms of the diagnosis and treatment and the limitations of the systems. And then I was also really readily available to relate to parents, and I think being able to bridge that gap has been it's something that I offer that's, I guess, unique, and why Healthy Hips, I'd say, has been able to expand quite quickly.
I would say personal experience combined with your professional health professional background is a very powerful means of communication to parents. And I guess I want to jump almost to the last question. What do you do at Healthy Hips? What sort of services do you offer, or education do you offer to help parents?
So we are a support and awareness organisation. So on the awareness side of things, we're trying to raise the profile of hip dysplasia amongst parents in the community. I always say to people when they ask, what do I do and why do I do? I always relate it to another childhood condition, or I shouldn't say condition, but SIDS, sudden infant death. And obviously the impact of that is even more significant than hip dysplasia. But what has happened in the last 20 years in terms of awareness for the condition has turned it from being something that no one knew about to something that you could almost stop an 18-year-old boy on the street, ask him what SIDS was, and he'd have a fair idea about the risk factors and the fact that parents need to be mindful of the environment that they set their baby up in to sleep. And my goal for hip dysplasia is that hip dysplasia is on the agenda of all parents, because it is the most common musculoskeletal birth anomaly or birth defect, which is a terrible word, but it is very common, yet awareness is quite low. So that's one big side of the organisation. The other side, which is the side which I probably comes from my heart more, is the support side. So we've established a nationwide peer support network. We run that online, and we've got groups of parents in each state and territory. We've also got groups specifically for children who face the surgical intervention for hip dysplasia, because their care needs are higher. And we have a group for adults with hip dysplasia and parents of children who are older than babies, because hip dysplasia impacts people over the lifespan. So peer support, online resources, we've got a lot of tips and hints, handouts. It's the practical day-to-day. That's the hardest part of hip dysplasia, is that you get diagnosed, you get given a harness or a brace, or the treatment method might be that you're coming back in for surgery. But once you leave the service provider, usually armed with information about the treatment time, how to keep the brace or harness clean, there's not an awful lot of practical day-to-day information about breastfeeding, clothing, positioning in car seats, prams, high chairs, coping mechanisms for parents. So that the whole coping aspect is probably the biggest part of what, you know, we're doing in the support space.
And it is all those little things that are probably forgotten when you know, a doctor or someone tells the mum, you've got hip dysplasia, here's a brace, you know, all the best, we'll see you in 3 months. I mean, there's so much more to this condition that impacts day-to-day life and functioning and sleep and behaviour of that child as they're growing. So you're absolutely right. Like, there are so many gaps that you can fill in here, and it's important to hear from other people who are going through this. And I'm just looking at your website, and it's healthyhipsaustralia.org.au, which is a fantastic resource. So my next question is going back to the start, and what is actually hip dysplasia? Can you explain that in simple terms, or is it a bit tricky?
Yep. So that's a really common question that I get. Used to be called clicky hips. A lot of people know of it as clicky hips. And professionally, it was called congenital hip dislocation or dysplasia, because it was thought that it was only at birth that a child would either have the condition or not. It's now in, you know, probably the last decade or so, now been called developmental dysplasia of the hips. Sometimes people call it DDH or hip dysplasia. And I cover all terms because sometimes people don't link that one is the same as the other. So it's quite a broad spectrum of hip dysplasia. It can range from a hip that is just mildly immature for the child's age and development, through to a fully dislocated hip. So it's when the hip ball and socket, as I like to describe to parents, don't fit together with the ball in the cup of the socket, in a nice deep centered cup, when they don't fit together correctly as they normally should, and it can be due to them not lining up correctly, or it can be due to lack of growth.
Okay. So how is it detected then? How you know, do babies show any signs of it, or does it need to be screened for through your GP or your child health nurse, or are there some clues or indicators as to which babies have this? That's a pretty big question.
Yeah. It is. So we can break it into risk factors, signs and symptoms, and causes. So if we're looking at the risk factors, so hip dysplasia, there is a strong relationship between a family history of hip dysplasia and the increased risk of a child getting hip dysplasia. The same goes too for breech position. Now, an important point about that is that it's to do with a baby lying in the breech position during pregnancy. And at any stage during the later stages of pregnancy, even if they turn at the last minute and they're delivered not in the breech position, that's still a period of time that they've spent in a compromised position in the womb. So that's something that parents really need to be mindful of. If their child was late turning, that they need to be flagging that their child did sit breech for a long period of time. It also is much more common in females. So 8 out of 10 cases are females versus 2 out of 10 being males. And firstborn. So the theory is that, as lots of doctors call it, it's a packaging condition, which when I first heard that, I thought, that's a rather interesting way of saying it. But when you break it down and you look at it, when you have your first baby, there's less room in the womb. And so babies are often sitting in a more compromised position with their legs in positions that perhaps are not ideal for the hip joint to develop during pregnancy.
Yeah. So perhaps this is actually starting from a very young age, you know, as the baby's growing in utero, it's actually starting to happen, these changes based on their positioning and where they are, I guess.
Yeah. Yes, so that's one thing. Obviously, there is another risk factor, swaddling, which we'll talk about later, because that's one that we can have an influence over because it's an environmental factor. But that's something that you were talking about before, that I often say to parents, it's not your fault. You had no control over the position in which your baby sat in your womb. Sometimes, yes, you can put a big tick against a family history. You can put a big tick against breech. But sometimes it's just purely that a child was first born. It's just purely that they were female. And look, there's plenty of cases where they're second born male as well. And that's where we're looking at, it's a condition that any child can be impacted by. Like I said before, it is the most common musculoskeletal birth defect between 0 and 5, which is why knowing the signs and symptoms and knowing how regularly your child's hips should be checked is vital.
Yeah, okay. And what percentage of babies would you say have hip dysplasia?
So there's a bit of discrepancy between stats globally versus in different regions of Australia. So the global statistics currently are that it's 1 in 100, which is actually quite high. So if you had 100 babies in the room, there's a pretty good chance that at least one has got hip dysplasia. In WA, between 2010 and 2014, the rate was as high as 1 in 50. It was believed that we were treating here in Western Australia the milder cases of hip dysplasia in the hope that we could prevent late diagnosis of the condition, which is an issue currently.
Okay, and they're the ones that have been picked up. So if you, you've got some of those risk factors, or even if you don't have those risk factors, when does this condition tend to be noticed or detected, and how would the doctor do that or the child health nurse do that?
Yep. So hip dysplasia, typically at time of birth, a baby will be given an examination which goes more or less from head to toe and covers everything in between, and the hips are checked at that point in time. And it's a physical check where the health professional is gently moving the hip to test whether or not the hip is able to be dislocated or if the hip is actually out of its socket and it's able to be popped back in. So that's a check that happens at birth. It normally also should be happening prior to discharge from hospital, and then at each of your child or family health nurse appointments, all the way through to, and this is the interesting point, till 3.5 years of age. So the focus has been on birth and 6 weeks.
That's right. And honestly, that's what I was thinking, is that initial one's very important, that 6 week check. It does tend to get a bit forgotten after that. So, you know, maybe this is a good chance for parents to think, well, there's other stepping stones when I do immunizations or I see the doctor, for them to quickly check the hips. And it's something I personally didn't realize how important it was even later on. What does the doctor do, you know, in terms of checking the hips? I do the maneuvers, which sort of look at the clicky nature of hip dysplasia problems. I've had child health nurses locally who would look for creases, abnormalities with the creases, asymmetry with the creases. Is that pretty much summing up what's, you know, ways to check this?
Yes. So, look, depending on the age of the child, the examination does change, but certainly in the early stages up to 6 to 12 weeks of age, being able to do the physical examination as you discuss with the manoeuvres, looking at whether or not the hip, ball and socket can be dislocated and put back into place, that sounds like it's going to hurt, but it doesn't. So it's an examination that does have to happen when the baby is calm and settled, which we all know newborns, it's a little bit tricky to get that time. And that's why Nicole Williams, who's the head of orthopaedic surgery in Adelaide at the Women's and Children's, she sits on our board at Healthy Hips Australia, and she says never miss an opportunity to check a baby's hips. If you pop into your GP because you're concerned about a high temperature, ask them to check the hips. If you go see your child health nurse because you're worried about feeding, ask them to check the hips. The immunisation time is a perfect time when you're coming in anyway to make sure that the hips get checked at each of those intervals, because it is a developmental condition and that the hips can slowly go off track or not keep up with the rate of the rest of the body growing. So that is the timing and the intervals for the checks. One of the best checks that I say that parents, in terms of, you know, tips that they can look out for, signs and symptoms at home, is if you're doing a nappy change of your baby and you're spreading their legs apart to change the nappy, they should be flexible enough that the outer edges of their knees and their thighs hit the table on both sides, almost like they're doing the splits with their knees sort of bent. Their legs should be able to flop all the way open. If you're finding that one side doesn't spread apart as easily as the other, or you've got this tiny little space to spread the legs apart, you've pried them apart, you're trying to do a nappy change, that can be a sign of issues with the hips. So it's a really good practical tip that parents can look for at home.
Yeah, it is good. And it's good to sort of put these things together, because I don't think one check does it justice. And I know there's certainly been cases where you examine them and they appear quite normal, but they actually do have hip dysplasia. So the examination isn't perfect, but the repeated checks and the watching and observing over that time frame, as you mentioned, is really important and easily forgotten as well. So that's the key message, is, you know, don't miss an opportunity. Is there anything, if for example, hip dysplasia isn't picked up early, are there any signs that you might see in children, you know, from 1-year-olds onwards, that could be an indicator that they might have hip dysplasia? So with their walking, delayed walking, pain in the hip, is there anything particular we could be considering or looking for?
Yeah, so certainly as a child gets older in those early stages, there are things that parents can be looking out for, but by the time they get to walking age, typically what you'll see is a leg length difference in the child, so one leg being longer than the other. So a dislocation on one side of the hip, they might tippy toe on one side. A lot of children tippy toe, but it's consistently just on one foot, which can be indicative of the hip not sitting in the socket and the difference in leg length. And typically children will have a sway back as well. So it's where they tend to stick their stomach out and their bottom sticks out, and a bit of a waddling walk. They're the signs. The hard part is that children can have fully dislocated hips and still manage to walk. So kids are just incredible. They're amazing. And that's why a fully dislocated hip, which is the most severe form of hip dysplasia, is actually the hardest to detect, because it won't present with the hip click when a doctor's doing their hip examinations early in stages, because the ball and socket are swimming miles apart. They're not going to click against each other to get the sound of them clunking in and out of position. So that's why being able to look for these, the legs spreading apart, the leg length difference, knowing your risk factors, if there was any family history of hip dysplasia, putting all those pieces of the puzzle together is what's vital, and then those ongoing checks.
Mm. So if in doubt, what are the tests that should be done? You know, we've talked about examination. We've got ultrasound and x-ray, I believe. Yes. Is that correct? So when do you suggest or suspect that they might be ordered? What age groups, that kind of thing?
Yeah. So when babies are born, there's a 1 in 10 chance of any baby having unstable hips, and they're often quite loose. And that's because at the time of birth, there's a lot of relaxant hormones running through mum's body to help get baby out. And so babies are quite... their joints are quite loose. So by the time a baby is 6 weeks of age, that's when a true indication of hip dysplasia can be determined. And that's when any queried hips that aren't positive for a dislocation, those ones will get treated before 6 weeks of age. But if there's any hips that are just queried, that they're a bit loose still, an ultrasound can be ordered, and that's able to determine whether or not there is indeed hip dysplasia requiring treatment or not, because we go from 1 in 10 at birth to 1 in 100 at 6 weeks. So a lot of those hips that are loose will spontaneously resolve themselves and not be an issue. So between 6 weeks and 6 months, ultrasound is the way of confirming hip dysplasia, and between 6 months of age and older, then it's an x-ray.
And for some of the chubbier legs, sometimes I find x-ray is needed a little bit earlier than that as well. So if hip dysplasia is confirmed, I know there's different categories of hip dysplasia. What are the common treatments that might be offered?
Sure. So, yes, as you say, it can range, and I think that's a key message that people are aware of, that hip dysplasia ranges from just mild through to severe. It can be treated by a harness or a brace. Typically, a harness and a harness is used between sort of the age of birth through to 4 to 6 months of age, bearing in mind that every child's different in size. The type of harness or brace varies from specialist to specialist, service to service, region to region. So in Australia alone, there is about 8 or 9 different types of harnesses and braces utilised for children. They all have the same level of effectiveness. There's factors that go into it in terms of, like I mentioned, size of baby, severity of the hip dysplasia in the first place. It can also be just a preference of the specialist that they've utilised a particular harness or brace through their training, and that they feel most comfortable with that. So the names of them vary. I think it's always important to, if you are diagnosed with it or your child's diagnosed, make sure they write it down for you, because I get a lot of parents come to me and say, look, my child's in something for something and I need help. So knowing what type of harness or brace, because it can change, you know, how they fit in clothing, car seats, prams, etc. So
as you say, it impacts all areas. And I had no idea there were 8 types of harnesses. And the brace itself puts those legs into a suitable position to help the hip grow into its position. So that might be, is that sort of the legs spread apart? Is that how it's put in?
Yeah. Yes. So yeah, the optimal position for healthy hip development is to have the legs spread apart, knees slightly bent. A lot of people refer it to a little frog.
Just a question I've had commonly asked by parents, and I want to make sure that I get this answer today. Are there any, what is the safest method to hold a baby's, you know, or maybe the flip side to that is it harmful to have a baby in a baby carrier in terms of hip development? And I don't know if you know the answer to this, but it's just raised a lot, and they're so helpful, those baby carriers sometimes. Also swaddling, you know, helping babies sleep. Are there any risks or concerns that we should be letting people know just to be careful with, basically?
Yeah, so baby wearing and swaddling are two hot topics that we spend a lot of time in the awareness space around. In countries, so research has shown that in countries where they baby wear their babies on their back and they're out in the fields doing work or out wherever they may be, they have very low rates of hip dislocation in those cultures. in countries where they wrap their babies tightly in swaddles, or they use cradle boards so their child looks like a tin soldier with their legs down straight together, the rate of hip dislocation is high. Mm. There was a really interesting study in Japan in the 70s, and the swaddling education was, the message was changed in terms of we need to allow room for the legs from the waist down, for the legs to kick in and out of that hip healthy position. And they also introduced a more thorough screening system at that time. But the rate of hip dislocations went from something like 4% down to 0.2%. And I will confirm those stats for you because they were truly remarkable in terms of the change in the swaddling practice. Mm. And then if you look at the correlation between the two, so you've got baby wearing, where you've got your baby, as I describe, as a newborn in a koala position or the little frog position. Obviously, when parents choose to baby wear in those first couple of weeks, they do need to choose the right carrier that ticks all of the other safety measures in terms of positioning and ability for the baby to breathe, etc. But from a hips perspective, a baby should be able to snuggle into you like a koala. You don't want to have them in a cocoon-like sling where the legs are going straight, so cradled across the body. You want to have their legs tucked up like in that little frog position. As they get a little bit older and they start to stretch out, their legs then wrap around you like a true koala. So baby wearing, where you're supporting their legs out underneath the thighs so that they've got a nice deep seat, is what you're looking for, which a lot of parents find that strange because they think, well, when my child's going to walk, they're going to walk with their legs down straight underneath them. So shouldn't I let their legs be allowed to drop down and encourage them down? And it's the opposite. We want to support them in the healthy hip position, which is that frog position. And if you look at a baby carrier, that is a good baby carrier. It looks like a child is wearing a harness anyway. So baby wearing is actually, in countries that you don't have access to orthopedic specialists, is the first line of recommendation in terms of pre-treatment treatment.
It's really good to know about the hip development, because it is opposite to what you think. And I'm hoping that a lot of the modern day swaddles incorporate some of that advice and some of that evidence to help it be easier for parents. There's already enough to think about, you know, but it's good to know that this is a safe position, even though sometimes it feels a bit uncomfortable. Are there any other support services other than Healthy Hips Australia, or is that something that's really needing to grow, parents can turn to? Or would you advise they start with your website and their GP or their child health nurse and go from there?
So Healthy Hips Australia is the only organisation in Australia that provides support and awareness for people impacted by hip dysplasia across the lifespan. Obviously, we'd love our service and the capacity for us to support people and to reach more people with our awareness to expand. The best port of call, obviously, for parents, if they have a child who's breech, they have a family history of Auntie Jane who had her hip replaced when she was in her 40s or 50s, Mum who has, you know, hip pain or limps, or there might have been a history of, as is often told to me, I was double nappied as a child, or I had clicky hips. Put those two things together, that is now hip dysplasia. Make sure you raise it with your GP or at the time of your child's birth, so that it can be flagged that they need that increased level of surveillance. But the key message for all parents is, just because your child doesn't have a family history, wasn't breech, or indeed wasn't female or firstborn, it doesn't mean that they're immune to hip dysplasia. And it's actually, like I said before, it's the non-classic risk factors that research has shown in the last decade has actually contributed to an increase in late diagnosis of hip dysplasia, which is a huge cause for concern.
Is surgery ever needed for these babies?
Yes, it is. The later a child is diagnosed, the increased their risk for them to need surgery. That's because when a baby's born, they've got the best chance of being able to respond to the harness and brace while all their bones and joints and everything is quite soft and able to be easily, as I say, moulded back into place in that first 12 weeks of life. If a child's hips are fully dislocated, sometimes they're not able to be put back into position and held there sufficiently by the harness or brace. They might need surgery. And also for adults, if hip dysplasia is not diagnosed until teenagehood or adulthood, it is the leading cause of early onset arthritis in women under the age of 50, and a hip replacement can be caused. So early diagnosis is key. We want to avoid pain. We want to avoid arthritis of the hip, impact on quality of life.
This has just been fascinating. I could keep asking questions. It's an area that I just didn't think of in enough depth and needed to know more about. And I think it's really important for the public to be aware of it, parents who are just embarking on the journey of having children. So, and who might have children who they're worried about. You've been a fantastic ambassador for HIPS and to create this website and to create this service and this support for parents. It just shows the power of, you know, actually going through something and then being able to transform that into educating and empowering others. So well done on that, Sarah, and thank you for coming today. You've been really interesting to talk to.
Thank you, I appreciate it.
This has been another Kids Health Network podcast. The information and advice provided here is for general purposes only. It is not an alternative to the medical advice offered in person by your GP, paediatrician, or other health professional relating to you or your child's specific condition. If you have concerns that you or your child is acutely unwell, please seek immediate medical attention. For more, find us on Facebook or Instagram at Kids Health Network.